This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, a threshold was recently crossed in West Africa. The Ebola epidemic was declared officially over in one of the hardest hit countries, Liberia.
Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea saw more than 11,000 people die during the outbreak, made worse by the fact that there was little or no medical infrastructure to handle the highly contagious and deadly disease.
It was months into the outbreak before the international community fully mobilized to help confront the epidemic. It's safe to say, Margaret, that the entire world community learned a tough but valuable lesson about what to do should there be another such epidemic.
And the World Health Organization learned from that experience, as we all do. They've since set up a $100 million fund so they won't be overwhelmed the next time by a global health crisis. And those countries that were so poorly equipped to handle the volume of disease now do have more resources at their disposal, newly erected clinics, emergency vehicles, and even the basics of sanitation and medical supplies.
You know, I often imagine how difficult it is to deliver critical care in some of these parts of the world with little or no health infrastructure.
And yet there's still so much to be improved upon here, even in our first world healthcare infrastructure. An estimated 100,000 Americans die each year, for example, from hospital-acquired infections or some other medical error in the hospital. And that is something that our guest today is very knowledgeable about.
Leah Binder is CEO of Leapfrog Group, an organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in hospitals. No matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Leah Binder in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. $200 million. That's the payout being paid to victims of the 2012 meningitis outbreak that sickened hundreds across the country, linked to a now-defunct pharmacy processing center in Massachusetts. 750 people were sickened and 64 died. The settlement in the bankruptcy hearings regarding the New England Compounding Center has been accepted by plaintiffs in the case. It also led to newer and more stringent regulations governing compounding pharmacies. Antibiotics use in animal production has led to a growing antibiotic resistance in humans. Now the FDA wants to get a better handle on how widespread the practice is. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration saying it's asking drug makers for data on antimicrobials sold for use in each food animal. The FDA believes the new detailed information will help discern patterns of resistance and identify disease trends related to the increased use of antibiotics in the food stream. Apparently, when employee wellness programs around smoking cessation offer to pay a worker a dividend for quitting, the motivation is far less effective than threatening to take money away. A recent UPenn study looked at different incentives to entice smokers to quit, and having a little skin in the game seemed to have an added incentive. The researchers compared a few approaches. Some people simply got cash for quitting. Others were offered a carrot and stick approach. They'd get a similar financial reward if they quit, but they'd also lose $150 of their own money if they started again. The deposit programs were twice as effective as rewards and five times more effective than providing free smoking cessation aids like nicotine replacement. And Elizabeth Bing has died. The centenarian was the mother of the Lamaze childbirth trend of the 20th century. She pushed the ideas of Dr. Fernand Lamaze to mostly male OBGYNs of the day who relied heavily on sedating mothers and isolating fathers during the childbirth experience. So-called natural childbirth involving preparing both mother and expectant fathers in relaxation and breathing techniques to get through labor without anesthesia. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Leah Binder, Chief Executive Officer of the Leapfrog Group, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in hospitals. At Leapfrog, Ms. Binder oversees the hospital survey and launched the hospital safety score system. She recently topped Modern Healthcare's list of 25 most influential women in healthcare. She earned two masters from UPenn in communications and government. Leah, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
You know, I'm really taken back by the number that you cite, that One in four Americans suffer from some kind of harm while in a hospital. And in spite of the growing interest in patient safety, these numbers loom large. Could you share with our listeners some of the more telling patient safety stats and what its cost is exactly to the healthcare system?
Well, I think the most disturbing statistic of all is that anywhere from 200,000 to 400,000 people die from preventable errors and accidents and infections in hospitals.
Wow.
That's a population the size of Miami.
Yeah.
The other thing that's disturbing is that's a broad range, 200,000 to 400,000. Even today, we really don't know exactly how many people die. So it really shows that not only are we in trouble, but we are also not doing what we need to do to hold health systems accountable. You can't hold them accountable if we don't even know the actual numbers. And so that is why LeapFrog exists, to recognize when the numbers are frightening, to do something about it, to drive a market for improvement, and to count.
I think we all want to think that patient safety is gaining traction, and a component of virtually every initiative is transparency. And
right.
The momentum, much of it came from concerned employers, the people who were paying the bills for healthcare, who saw rapidly rising medical costs. So maybe tell us just a little more about how LeapFrog got launched as an organization to address these concerns.
These are large companies such as Boeing, and what they said to LeapFrog in the beginning is that they often spend more on health benefits than they earn in profits, yet they cannot hold the healthcare system accountable for its performance in the same way that their own products and services are held accountable for their performance. So a good example is GM. The automakers were very active from the beginning in LeapFrog because their products, cars, are held to a very high level of scrutiny and have been really from the beginning. So they said to LeapFrog back in 2000, what we want now is a national report card that will allow our employees to compare among hospitals on how they're doing in safety. And we launched LeapFrog with something called the LeapFrog Hospital Survey, which asks hospitals to voluntarily report to us on how they're doing on key metrics of safety and quality. So that really was the founding notion, and it remains really a founding principle of LeapFrog. We formed very strong relationships with experts in the field, such as Lucian Leap, who actually was one of our founders as well, but a number of really significant, what I call dream team experts, who are really focused and thinking about patient safety every day. They advise us on absolutely everything that we do, and those experts have helped us assure that integrity, but also to really think about what's next. What are the next major areas that we can push hospitals to get even better? And then a whole variety of like-minded organizations that really do care. Providers and hospitals themselves have, in fact, become active in LeapFrog. Many providers are very excited about LeapFrog and really do help us to advance our agenda even more.
Well, Leah, I think if our listeners are hearing those numbers correctly, they'll immediately go to the LeapFrog Hospital Survey, which is really considered the gold standard in hospital safety and quality comparison. But you have a recent effort, which is called the Hospital Safety Score, which has also been gaining a lot of attention and traction. And it ranks the nation's hospital with a letter grade based on 26 specific points of observation from about 2,500 of the nation's hospitals. So what are some of the criteria that are being graded on? How does the grading work? And how would our listeners access something like this?
Well, the voluntary aspect of LeapFrog is the LeapFrog Hospital Survey. It is the gold standard in transparency and quality rating for hospitals. That's where we ask hospitals to voluntarily report to us on their uncertain metrics of their quality and safety that are important to people, particularly important to purchasers and important to patients. 1,500 hospitals across the country voluntarily provide us with that data, which we publicly report, and we also allow others to report, so all the health plans, all the national health plans use it, et cetera. The other initiative you point out is an initiative we started 3 years ago called the Hospital Safety Score, and that's the letter grade that we assign to all general hospitals in the United States based on how safe they are for their patients. That is not voluntary. That is a letter grade we assign regardless of whether the hospital has decided to report this data publicly or not. We are able to assess a letter grade for hospitals by using data that is publicly available from the federal government, from CMS, the agency that runs Medicare. And so we are able to use data from Medicare and some other data we're able to find in the public domain. If a hospital also reports to our LeapFrog hospital survey, then we also use that data. But if they don't report to us, we don't use it. It doesn't hurt them or it doesn't help them either way. Just we don't use it if we don't have it. That is a way that we are able to capture for the public very critical information about how a hospital is doing on the things you don't want to have happen at a hospital. So you go to a hospital for a procedure, you want to get better, you want a knee replacement so you can walk better, et cetera. And there are rating systems that will look at how a hospital does. Our letter grade is looking at something else. We're looking at the bad things that happen, to put it bluntly. We're looking at the infection rates, the injury rates, the falls, the trauma, the mistakes in medications, the unfortunate series of errors and accidents that happen all the time in hospitals. And we're rating the hospital on how well they do in preventing those things. So a hospital that gets an A for safety is a hospital that is safer than a hospital that gets a D. It's a very important piece of information that it really should be, the first thing you look at. Mm-hmm. Safety comes first. You can go to a hospital with an excellent heart surgeon, but if you get an infection in recovery, it doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. So our score, the hospital safety score, was developed by a group of experts, Lucian Leap among them, actually, and some very well-known patient safety experts, and they're all listed on our website, mm-hmm. hospitalsafetyscore.org. And they came up with a way of assessing those 28 measures of safety and helped us to develop the score in really a scientifically sound way. And if you go and look at the letter grade for a particular hospital, you can click in and get more detail on that hospital. We will show you how the hospital did on every one of the measures we looked at. So you can really drill down and understand a lot about that hospital safety record.
I know you have some company in the hospital rating arena. Medicare just came out with its own hospital mm-hmm. rankings. You know, the healthcare industry is completely absorbed in preparing for this shift to something called the ICD-10. That right. we've been using for the last 30 years. And one of the key recommendations for doing it, if you look at all the teaching material for all of us in healthcare, a reason to do it is just this, to be able to understand at a much more granular level what is happening in terms of safety and quality, both in the hospital setting and the outpatient setting. And I'm wondering if you have any predictions or thoughts on how much your ratings will change when we get that much better level of data.
I think we will have better ratings because really we are all dependent on the publicly available data from the federal government. In some cases, there's some state data that many of us use. In LeapFrog's case, we actually are able to go and collect data directly from hospitals. And we are reporting data that's otherwise unavailable. So we do have that. But anyway, the raters will have better data. You know, this ICD-10 conversion is something that is discussed a lot in the healthcare community. It's a major shift for hospitals and healthcare providers, and it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. Most people don't perhaps realize this, but most of what we know about the performance of healthcare systems comes from billing data. Mm-hmm. So basically claims, so whatever it is that a hospital, for example, bills for, we can aggregate all those bills and figure out how often they did a knee replacement and how often someone, for example, died from a procedure. We can see that because it's in the bill. Well, if it doesn't merit being included in the bill, then we don't know it. And there's a huge amount of quality information about the performance of systems that's never going to make it into a bill. And what happens with ICD-10 is it's a conversion of the way they do billing in healthcare, and that allows for more granular information about quality because it incorporates that more into the billing codes. Virtually the entire world has converted to ICD-10 except for the United States, so it really is time for us to do it.
We're speaking today with Leah Binder, Chief Executive Officer of the LeapFrog Group, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in hospitals. At LeapFrog, Ms. Binder is responsible for the LeapFrog Hospital Survey and for launching the Hospital Safety Score System. You recently wrote about the need for bipartisan action on healthcare transparency. And are there any champions out there that we should know about or keep our eye on?
Most of the public has now moved into high deductible health plans. Something like 65% of workers in the country now have very high deductible health plans. What that means is that the average consumer is now much more price conscious than ever before. If you're paying the full cost of your MRI, so it's changing, I think, the public mood around pricing in healthcare. And as a result, there's a great deal of interest on the Hill among policymakers in figuring out how we can get consumers to get their hands on information. And so if you, for example, are facing the need for a procedure, it is actually quite difficult to find out who's the best surgeon. There's very minimal ratings of physicians and surgeons, and most of it is not going to give you the kind of information that any of us would want to know before we go under the knife. Another thing we don't have information about is hospitals have to go through accreditation in order to qualify to accept Medicare payments. And those reports of what happens when the Joint Commission goes on site at a hospital and observes how they're doing in a variety of quality and safety metrics are not made public. That's another source of information that it seems to me. But I think there's a larger number of performance issues that we'd all want to know about for which we have almost no data or no data at all.
Well, Leah, you've been very instrumental at LeapFrog in generating attention and focus on a problem area that other organizations like the March of Dimes have also been focused on for years, and that's reducing harm to newborns or improving birth outcomes by reducing the number of early elective deliveries, which accounts for a significant number of complications and NICU stays for babies who are just born before the optimal time. Tell us a little bit about the scope of this problem and how the LeapFrog Hospital Survey is making an impact on that.
Of course, I've talked to employers for whom maternity care is half of their spend on health care in general. Until LeapFrog came along, there was very little information for people to know by provider how they're doing. So we started reporting back in 2010 on early elective deliveries. These are deliveries that are scheduled without a medical reason between 37 and 39 weeks. Now, when they're scheduled before the 39th week has been completed of a pregnancy, they put both the mother and the baby at risk. And the baby in particular often ends up in the NICU because there's a lot of change that happens at those last 2 weeks of development. That's something why the March of Dimes has been so active in trying to curtail these unnecessary deliveries. So we started reporting rates of early elective deliveries, and we found, to our astonishment, that the rates were very high. They were something like 17%. What we also found, and we find in virtually everything we look at, some hospitals had rates as high as 40 or 50%, and others had rates as low as zero. And so we started reporting that, and it really galvanized action, because there's something special about seeing in print how your hospital compares to the one down the street. And it motivated a real movement, starting with the March of Dimes, but also a number of other organizations and individuals got very actively engaged in trying to bring these rates down. And in our last round of reporting, the rate nationally is now below 5%. So this has been an enormously effective movement, and it just shows how important transparency really can be in motivating change. We didn't make any change, but we put the numbers on the table, and that made a difference.
We've been speaking today with Leah Binder, Chief Executive Officer of the LeapFrog Group, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in hospitals. You can learn more about their work by going to leapfrog.org or by following her on Twitter at Leah Binder. Leah, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, listeners may wonder how effective fact-checking in journalism can be, especially considering that politicians repeat many false and misleading claims over and over again. We've long said that our job at factcheck.org isn't to change politicians' behavior. Rather, our focus is on arming voters with accurate information. And two new studies show that fact-checking can indeed lead to a better informed public. The American Press Institute's Fact-Checking Project published both studies. One, by a political scientist at Columbia University, found that even though false claims on Twitter hugely outnumber attempts to correct them, fact-checkers do appear to help Twitter debates become more accurate over time. For instance, the study analyzed tweets about a false claim that 2 million Americans would lose their jobs because of Obamacare. As we've reported before, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that 2 million people would decide not to work, such as retiring earlier, or to work less because of the law, not that they would lose their jobs. But the Columbia study found that tweets endorsing the false claim outnumbered those attempting to correct it by a ratio of 13 to 1 in the first 3 months of 2014. Still, the study found the relative share of corrective tweets increased as these types of social media frenzies started to fizzle. Another study by a professor at George Washington University found that many Americans not only believe things that aren't true, but are very confident that their false notions are correct. But the study then tested whether fact-checking could correct mistaken beliefs. It found encouraging results. About a month after the initial survey, the study gave the correct information once and briefly to those who had held mistaken beliefs. It found a significant decrease in misperceptions in those who were told the correct information. So there's some support to show that fact-checking can indeed set the record straight. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Much attention has been paid of late to the need to give the nation's children ways to be more active. It's something the not-for-profit playground development agency Kaboom has been focused on for years. But a recent trend out of Europe and Asia has shown that kids' playgrounds maybe should not be designed just for kids, but should be reimagined and redesigned for all generations to exercise, play, and have fun, especially with a growing population of seniors in this country.
In recent years, we've had funders and or community partners that have a particular interest in bringing this multi-generational piece into it. And so we've been able to be responsive to those requests. So whether it's a request for adult-focused space or senior-focused space, we're able to be responsive to that.
Kelly Griffin is Director of Strategy at Kaboom, which partners with communities that seek to build playgrounds that meet an unmet need. And she says that these senior playgrounds, which have taken off in places like England, Finland, and parts of Asia, are now being asked for by clients here in the U.S. They decided, well, rather than build a separate playground for seniors, let's incorporate them into the children's play space. The elder-focused playgrounds are filled with all kinds of exercise equipment that fit naturally into the playground setting, but they're also designed to be easily managed by older folks with the common ailments of stiff joints, mobility problems, and balance issues.
So at a community learning center outside of Orlando called the Midway Safe Harbor Center, once we built the playground and the adult fitness stations adjacent, we saw a significant increase in the number of grandparents and children using the space together. And because of the new equipment, they've now added programming, both for the adults and for the adults and the kids, to work together. So really having the adults setting the example for kids.
Playgrounds designed not just with children in mind, but reimagined to keep kids of all ages actively engaged in movement and exercise, providing communities with a fun way to keep fit and active well into the older age. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.